Welcome to another episode of the Wednesday Conversation. I'm Dusty White. I'm here with Pastor Bob Thune of Cormdale Church and Pastor Chris Hemmelman of First City Church. On Wednesdays, we sit down to talk about how the gospel of Jesus Christ connects to the questions and issues of everyday life. And today we're asking the question, what is post-liberalism?
Wow. Okay.
Heady. I mean, why not, you know?
Man.
I just came up with that question just right here, right now.
Guys, I want to apologize because I had hip surgery back in December, and what that meant is I sat around my house for a couple weeks and just had a lot of time to think and read stuff, and so I was going down some rabbit holes, and yeah, I sent you guys some articles. You're like, hey, this would be a great topic, and problem is it's like kind of a dense topic.
Well, that's all right. Somebody asked me on our staff, hey, have you talked to Bob? And I was like, yeah, he just sent me this crazy article, so he's doing all right. He's reading, studying.
Okay, so I want to try to frame up the conversation this way. The question a lot of people are asking in Western society right now is, where are we headed? And we talked about this a little bit last week. You know, we're 80 years after World War II. We're definitely, you know, 35 years past the end of the Cold War. And there's ways in which the old regime has kind of fallen apart. You know, I think we all realize we're sort of living on the cusp of some change. You can frame that a lot of different ways, but one way that a lot of people have described that is that liberalism has sort of collapsed. Now, when I say liberalism, don't think about liberal versus conservative. Think about like democracy, like the tradition of how we understand freedom, right? Libertas is the Latin word for freedom or liberty. And so if you think about everything we love as Americans, freedom, liberty, independence, self-determination, we're talking about the philosophical tradition that gave rise to all those political values. And so a lot of people are asserting that kind of the liberal consensus is kind of what's falling apart. And now what you have is, you know, you have nationalism is kind of arising, populism is kind of arising. There's all these, you know, if you ask, you know, how is America now different from like the America of the Clinton administration, right? In the America of the Clinton administration, you had Democratic liberals and Republican liberals who just disagreed on whether we should be a little more progressive or a little more conservative, but they were all committed to the free market economy. They were all committed to sort of like basic American power in the world. There was sort of a set of things that they sort of all agreed on. If you ask, where are we politically now? You have like certain streams that are very nationalistic. You have kind of a raw populism. You have progressivism. You have the woke agenda. You have sort of classical liberal. So there's much more differentiation now than there would have been 30 or 40 years ago. And so what these thinkers, this piece that I'm referencing here that we'll talk about in a minute, some thinkers in the UK are putting forward a manifesto saying, hey, we live in a post-liberal moment, and we ought to be convictionally post-liberal. Now, they're going to try to define for us what they mean by that. But I just want us to think about it as thoughtful Christians, because I do think part of our calling as God's people in the world, especially living in a society, is to ask, what is the cohesive element in our society right now? And what these authors are saying is, we don't really have one. And Christianity has a chance to assert one. Now, you're going to be able to judge, are they true? Are they right about that, or are they wrong about that? But I at least want to read to you what their case is. And I think I would fall more in a post-liberal camp. I would say like, yeah, I actually think sort of renewing classical liberalism probably is not going to happen, although there are people who would disagree with that. So let me try to frame up some terms and just see if I can get us in the conversation.
Would you say you wouldn't be in that camp because it's just too far gone?
Like, yeah, I think it's too far. I just don't. Well, it's not that it's not worth it. It's that I think we've moved beyond the point where anybody agrees on those things. And let me, so I'm going to start with a different article that I was reading that just mentions the same thing. And so I want to read this author's definition of liberalism and post-liberalism, and then we'll jump into the article we're actually talking about. This is from an author named Nathan Pinkosky.
That means you had a footnote moment where you were like, I did the footnotes.
I did. He writes, 20th century civilization has collapsed. It rested on an essential tenet of liberalism, the distinction between state and society, public and private. this distinction reached its apogee, that's its like apex, its highest point, in the mid-20th century, when the triumph and challenges of the post-war moment clarified the importance of defending social freedom from state power while ensuring that the public realm was not taken over by private interests. So to think about what he's talking about there, think about communism, right? You have the state mm-hmm. taking over and suppressing social freedom and people's, you know, freedom to do what they want in the world. You also had, on the opposite side, the public realm being taken over by private interests. That's sort of like the 1890s in America, where you had the rise of monopolies and robber barons and all these industries that are sort of like, you know, building fabulous wealth at the expense of the average person. What liberalism was an attempt to avoid both of those extremes. Let's not be communists. Let's also not allow private interest to take over the social realm. This author goes on to say, like it or not, the West is now post-liberal. Post-liberal thinkers argue that the liberal state's rejection of a substantive vision of the good hollows out politics and civil society. Liberalism produced a state bent on driving tradition and religion out of public life, an atomistic society in which money is the only universally acknowledged good. Post-liberals contend that if our ruling classes relinquished their liberal commitment to neutral institutions in favor of a substantive vision of the good, we could renew our civilization. That's a great, so what they're saying is liberalism relied on this idea that the public square should be neutral. That what we should be as a society is the things we can agree on are like, let's make money together. Let's participate in the free market together. Hey, if you want to be a Buddhist and you want to be a Christian and you want to be an atheist, great. Keep those things out of the public square. The public square should be neutral. And what we can advance together is just sort of our common shared interest in freedom. The way I would describe it is to say it this way. Liberalism believed that if we just make individual freedom the highest good, then everybody pursuing their own individual freedom will make for a great society because we'll have maximal freedom. Everybody's free to do what they want to do. And everybody, as long as they have the freedom to pursue their interests and, you know, live the life they want to live, that should lead to flourishing for everyone. So that's how we got the free market economy. That's why we have in America a high entrepreneurship and capitalism. There's low, you know, low government putting its thumb on the scales when it mm-hmm. comes to economics. It's also how we got gay marriage because, you know what, yeah. you know what, just let people do what they want to do. You know, you're free to love who you want to love, kind of an approach. That's a vision of a liberal society. Yeah. Maximize individual freedom. The state shouldn't get involved in that stuff.
And that's an example of an uncriticized internal belief that we just have been formed in and shaped in. Because what you just described is where the average person is just going to uncritically say, that's this freedom. Is about, and this is what it should be.
Right.
No sense of like where that came from, whether that's true or not. It's just, yes, that's a self-evident truth. Like we talked about last week, that just kind of just pulled out of the sky that this is what we should believe. So yeah, that's a great definition that I think is very easy to see and understand because that's just the air we breathe.
Okay. So where the post-liberals are going to critique that, what they want to argue is the problem with liberalism is that it has no substantive vision of the good. In other words, it doesn't try to define the good. It doesn't say marriage is good or having kids is good or living within your means is good or staying out of debt is good or gambling is good or addiction is good. It claims to be neutral on the question of the good. And what these post-liberals are trying to argue is society can't operate that way. Every society has to have a substantive vision of the good. And when you pretend that one doesn't exist or that you can just not have one, what ends up becoming the good is money. And this is a fact. That's what these thinkers are asserting is that we are in a post-liberal moment. And what that means is we need to put forward a substantive vision of the good. We need to rally around some vision of what is the good. Now, you might disagree with their assertion of what that should be, but I think it's interesting to just ask the question, do you agree with our basic premise that society can't exist without some agreement on what's the good?
Yeah. As a side note, this is why I no longer am a libertarian, is like you start to I think I matured a little bit in my thinking, but sorry to all the libertarians that listen to this, but here's a little dose of reality. Libertarianism is exactly what Bob described. It reduces everything down to freedom, ultimately about economics. It's no positive vision for the good. Find one libertarian thinker that has like libertarianism as a thing, as a pot. So anyway, that's just a side note, but yes, I'm affirming everything you're saying here.
Let me read their. So now I'm going to move to this article called What is Post-Liberalism Now? This is from the New Statesman, December 2024. It's written by a bunch of thinkers in the UK. Some of these people I know, some of them I'm familiar with at a distance. But they're sort of all committed together to, we are convictionally post-liberal. And when they say post-liberal, they just mean we no longer agree that we can have any kind of a society based on just freedom alone. So they're saying, hey, if you agree with us, come over here and be a post-liberal and let's try to build something, whatever comes after liberalism. Because what they're saying is liberalism has fallen apart. We haven't yet built anything after it, but the post just sort of means whatever's next, it's definitely not liberalism. They're going to explain that more in a minute, but let me read you first of all their what they see when they look at society and see if it names the same thing that you see. They write, everywhere we look, at every level, political, social, economic, environmental, international, the old order is collapsing and no one knows how to save it. In the personal sphere, the fulfillment of our most intimate needs and desires for friendship and family, home and belonging, dignity and purpose, beauty and love, seems increasingly out of reach. In the public sphere within every nation, there is widespread institutional breakdown, corruption, and degradation of civic life. Between nations, there is growing conflict, sometimes breaking out into war. It certainly seems there like they're naming some things I can identify. I mean, if you look at our society and ask, yeah, I hear from a lot of younger people that, man, I just don't know who to be. I don't know what I should live my life for. I don't know how to have sort of like a vision and a purpose and a sense of that maybe I could achieve something in the world that would give meaning and purpose and significance to my life. I mean, I think they're in this idea of institutional breakdown. I think we would say, yeah, that's why the church is more fraught than it's ever been. It's just because people don't quite know how to participate in an institution. And, you know, all the things we used to belong to are less and less cohesive than they once were.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They're naming that the reality that we're all feeling when it comes to like, I know what you're against. I just have no idea what you're for.
Right. Exactly. This great unraveling has revealed the bankrupt ideal of liberalism itself. The myths of liberalism, once so compelling and apparently humane, have been tested to destruction. The autonomous individual, the absolute sovereignty of the nation state, the benign character of a globalized market, perpetual progress and a worship of liberty as the highest end in itself rather than the pursuit of mutual flourishing and the common good. In both the economic and the cultural realm, it turned out that individualism cannot of itself generate a substantive order. Instead, the clash of interests leads to ever more inequality and alienation, and the control of populations by oligarchic and technocratic elites. That's an interesting statement to me because I do think we sort of see this arising technocracy. Like the top seven stocks in America right now are all tech companies. You know, it's just like there is a technocratic elite that has sort of arisen in the last decade.
I saw that a number of the big tech, like Zuckerberg, they're contributing to Trump's inauguration and all this stuff. So it's like they're trying to get all cozy with,
they're all
with
in.
The president. Yeah.
Yeah.
And we're definitely in that spot where the government's not sure what to do with them. And so they just have to like pull them in a little bit.
Right. And we're also in a time, again, because we bought into the idea that you should be free to maximize whatever profit you want to maximize. There's no one in our government right now that's going to say, actually, there should be a boundary there. You should not be able to make money off that. There should be some kind of regulation there. We have sort of this rampant, I mean, it's kind of the war of all against all, right? It's the decline. What you see in what they're describing is the lack of a cohesive vision of the common good or a substantive vision of here's what we're about together as a society, other than get rich, man.
Mm-hmm. Which is why people are fascinated with Elon.
Yeah.
But also we're all in the back of our minds going like, can you do that?
Yeah. Let me get you to their definition of post-liberalism. They're going to give three things that post-liberalism is. Okay. So when they say, hey, this is a manifesto, we think you should be a post-liberal. Here's what they mean. Post-liberalism is, first, the recognition of this reality that liberalism has mutated into an intolerant ultra-liberalism. So first thing they say is it's just an acknowledgement that liberalism has eaten itself. Second, the argument that liberalism alone was never sufficient. And third, the conviction that respect for liberty must be balanced by a shared pursuit of economic justice and the common good. So, you are a post-liberal if, one, you agree that liberalism has mutated into sort of like a some version of itself that's destructive. Two, that liberalism alone was never sufficient. And three, that respect for liberty needs to be balanced by the pursuit of economic justice and the common good. That's their conviction.
Okay.
What do you think, Chris? Are you a post-liberal yet?
I think so. I think I'm there. Well, at least in that definition, as far as like, how do you build on the other side of that? That's the question that after reading this article, I'm like, so what exactly does it mean for the, like, what are they advocating as far as like how we sort of rebuild from the ruins of liberalism?
Yeah. Great question.
What's interesting about just them putting this forward is it's pretty easy to feel like, yeah, I'm ready for something different.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Well, I think that's what they're trying to do is I anticipate they're just trying to get a conversation started about, can we talk about something besides just freedom and maximizing income? Is that like, can we have a conversation about what could a substantive vision of the good be? We might disagree on what it should be for the next 30 years, but at least we need to have a conversation moving in the direction of what could that be.
Yeah.
So what they describe is that basically what happens as liberalism eats itself is you have sort of an unfettered capitalism that ends up exploiting human beings. And I think you see, like, I feel this, like, think about, so here's what I've experienced recently. I was telling my family this, you know, years ago living in Omaha, you know, I was like, all right, who do I want my internet to be provided by? You know, is it Cox? Is it CenturyLink? Is it like whatever company, you know? And I was a Cox customer because I was like, man, there's Cox guys that live in my neighborhood. They park their trucks on the street. And every time I call the phone number, I'm talking to a real human being that lives in Omaha, Nebraska. And I appreciate that. Like they're my neighbors and they're people that I know in the city. So I was a Cox customer for that reason, right? Today, if you call Cox customer service, it's a call center somewhere on the other side of the world. You will not talk to someone for whom English is their first language, nor is there any meaningful way that they will like act on your behalf, right? The first seven layers are just like, you know, can I reset your device? Have you signed up for our new service? Can I sell you a new modem? Like it's clear to me that they're just trying to sort of extract profit and that the business is no longer built around like serving our neighbors for the sake of their good. It's just about like, how can we continue to maximize profit margin and minimize expense? And that's how every industry right now sort of has to function, because if the only goal is what's the common good, make as much money as you can, that's where we end up. And I think I feel that in a lot of different layers of my life where it's like, man, I used to really appreciate that this business was local and I could do business with a person. And as the business has grown, it's either gotten sold to a competitor that's sort of like gutting it for money, or it's just trying to maximize profit and minimize cost. Yeah. And there ends up being no shared vision of like, what's good? What would be good for people?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we see that all over the place, even in medicine, you know, like that's definitely the case at most doctor's offices right now.
Yeah.
Well, it's even interesting how that is connected in some ways to the whole tariff conversation too. Because as much as that is an economic thing, there is a sense in which that conversation has this place, because tariff, the idea is, hey, we're trying to drive stuff back here, home. And there's underneath that conversation is a vision of the good. It's good for a country. So yeah, it is interesting how that's playing out.
Yes. Now, these authors are going to say, okay, so how could we arrive at a substantive vision of the good? To your question, Chris, how could we get back there? What could we propose? What they say is the redemption of the worst of the West can only be by the best of the West. So they're going to say the West, Western culture actually has a great heritage going all the way back to Augustine and Aristotle of personal rights, associative bodies, the common good, basic humanism. And what this all goes back to is society as more fundamental than politics and the economy. They say it this way, both the political and the economic are embedded in the social. And if you want to ask, what have we gotten wrong? It's that. It's that right now, our social life is subsumed under politics and the economy. If you ask, what are the two things that dominate all the news coverage and that most of us fret the most about or care the most about, it's politics and the economy.
Mm-hmm.
The economy including how are my investments doing? Can I pay my bills? All the way up to, you know, how are we going to do tariffs and exports and what's our economic policy nationally? But the idea is the way that that liberalism has destroyed our society is that everything is subsumed to politics and the economy. In fact, you even see this, it's an interesting connection to the trans conversation because you might have noticed recently the UK has almost totally reversed course on its trans policies. I mean, it's going very much in the opposite direction. And the reason the US hasn't is because there's a lot of money in transgender surgery and there's a lot of political interest very committed to trans rights. No one's asking the question, is this actually good for the human beings that we're that we're either harming or serving? So it's interesting that when you elevate politics and economics, it ends up those two things become most important. And what that does is it destabilizes and kind of destroys the social fabric that holds people together. What they're saying is the best of our tradition always understood that society is more fundamental than politics and the economy. And actually, this is why people really like small towns, because in most small towns, that's still true. It's still just like, well, the guy that runs the grocery store is also the guy that lives down the street from you. And the principal of the high school is also the person that, you know, you just know that there's a social fabric there that when it comes down to it, if that person rips you off, the rest of the town's going to hold them accountable for it. And if that person's a jerk, it's not going to go very well for them. And so, there was a social order that was more fundamental than the political and economic.
Yeah. I mean, even think of like the biblical vision of this too. I mean, leaving aside the specific laws, but there is a fundamental core of, hey, the reason you treat people of economic justice, that's your brother.
Right.
That's your community, that's your kin. And so there's a bond there beyond just economics or political that is more important.
These authors write, in the face of today's liberal crisis, the first priority is to renew the West from within. The cultural tradition of the West can be summarized as a quest for a flourishing human life in which all can freely participate. I think that's just a compelling vision, a flourishing human life in which all can freely participate. And what they want to suggest is this is going to require agreement on some substantive vision of the good, but that does not mean we throw out all the good of liberalism. So when they say they're post-liberal, what they want to convince you of is we're not opposed to freedom and to individual rights and flourishing. What we want to do is combine that with a more substantive understanding of human flourishing, right? A world where we can all participate together, a flourishing human life in which all can freely participate. So let me read you what they want to do with the heritage of liberalism. First, they say post-liberalism is committed to renewing the liberal in an older sense of generosity, tolerance, and civility of manners. That was exemplified in the social order of the post-war era when liberalism was still embedded in inherited networks of associate corporate bodies. So what they're saying is that there's this sense of generosity, tolerance, civility that used to be true in our world that we've kind of lost. And we want to renew that sense of like liberal, how would you describe this? Just like civil discourse, right? Mm-hmm. Treating one another with humanity, respect.
Charity.
Yeah, that's actually one of the best heritages of liberalism. And it comes to us from the fact that in the earliest you know, think back to colonial America, everybody had to get along. Like, you're 13 colonies and you have all these sort of free associations of human beings. You're a part of maybe the, you know, the town, the church in town, but you're also part of the business owners club. And you're also, you know, you're associated with all these various bodies in society that give it its fabric. So they're committed to that. Second, post-liberalism is committed to renewing the principles of liberality, like free speech, free association, and free religious practice. The reason why mere liberalism threatens free debate is that freedom of speech assumes the possibility of a shared quest for objective metaphysical truth, which is what liberalism on its own denies. That's a fascinating point.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you have thoughts about that, Chris, but basically what they're saying is mere liberalism, so like thin liberalism like we have now, actually threatens debate. It kills freedom of speech because freedom of speech assumes that we're pursuing truth, that there's a truth we can actually arrive at. And as soon as you say, that's not what we're pursuing anymore, now it's just a quest for power. And if I want my side to win, then I don't want your side to talk because we might become convinced that you're right. So this is what, like what my kids who have gone to colleges that are more defined by the woke agenda will tell you is like, yeah, there's actually no free reasoning in any class. You have to agree with the party line. So you just sort of like keep your head down and write the paper and, you know, say the things about racism or DEI or whatever that the professor wants to hear. In the process of doing that, no one's growing, no one's learning, no one's being challenged, no one's actually reasoning.
Mm-hmm.
It's a muting of the kinds of freedom liberalism in its true form actually enjoys and wants to put forward. So they're saying post-liberalism would renew principles of freedom of speech, freedom of association, freedom of religious practice in their full sense of like, hey, let's pursue truth together. Nothing wrong with that. In fact, when we disagree in the pursuit of truth, that's how most great learning and great creativity comes to light. And the third is they say post-liberalism is not anti-liberal when it comes to policing and punishment. They want a political order that helps to make people virtuous and therefore a vision of justice that's inherently restorative that would seek to rehabilitate people and bring them back to full flourishing. And combining that with effective policing and the support of safety in the community. So they say at the heart of post-liberalism is not the denial of the importance of personal freedom, but the primacy of interpersonal relations over impersonal forces. So I think their vision is just like, let's get back to a relational vision of society rather than one that's driven by impersonal forces.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds as if in calling themselves post-liberal and saying something after liberalism, they're not trying to say we're rejecting liberalism. No. So they're trying to be very clear. They're not rejecting. But I think this is the question that I have. And if this is a little ahead of where you want to be, we can come back to it. But my question when I read this article is like lots of things in here. Hey, this is good. This is good. But what they describe, and maybe they have more details to fill this out, sounds a lot like classical liberalism in the early days. More so than something very different. I mean, yeah, different in what it is now because of so how far things have mutated. But if we're with what they describe, sounds like, hey, back, you know, further back in our tradition, there was an expression of liberalism that was that valued these things more, whether consciously or just because it was kind of going off the fumes of previous generations. And so that's the biggest question I have with post-liberalism is how is this different than, you know, what we had in the 1800s or, you know, just pick a date where liberalism maybe felt more healthy in our society.
Chris, I think you're asking a great question. And I think at one level they would probably say, yeah, we're just saying go back to, but I think this is where they would say the difference is that philosophically, so if you think about the classic liberal thinkers, John Stuart Mill, John Locke, Kant, Hume, the sort of philosophical leaders that shaped what became the liberal philosophical tradition, I think they would say there were errors in the philosophy that they want to avoid replicating.
Yeah.
And the primary error was that if we maximize individual freedom, that will get us to some vision of the good. That like individual freedom is a replacement for the common good. And I think what they would say is that's a faulty premise.
Okay.
There was never a way we were just going to say, let's just commit to freedom and that's going to get us where we want to go, because freedom is not an end. Freedom is a means to some other end.
Yeah. Yeah. Right? Okay. So maybe another way to process this then, if I'm a post-liberal thinker and trying to be an influencer here, is I'm trying to think through what did those guys unhitch us from that has caused kind of the mess that we're in.
Yes.
And so what does it mean to kind of get rehitched back to the tradition that actually helped us thrive and flourish?
Excellent question. So now I'm going to go off script. I'm not going to speak for these guys. I'm just going to say what I think the answer is based on some reading I've done, but I might be, I don't want to make these guys cop to my thinking here. But I think what I would say is the substantive good underneath liberalism was always the Judeo-Christian heritage.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you think about what was Christendom, quote unquote, it's basically all of Western culture since Constantine, right? So there was this huge tradition of basically a concept of human rights, a concept of a society. What does it mean to pursue one another's good? What does it mean to disagree charitably? What does it mean to forgive one another? There was this whole substantive reality underneath that I think what the Enlightenment thinkers did is they jettisoned the authority structure of that. They said, hey, the church can't tell us how to think. We're going to think for ourselves. But there was still sort of in society, there was just implicit shared sense of the good. If you think about how could the founding fathers of America start a new country and say something like Jefferson said, we hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal. Well, it's because back then there was a shared philosophical or Christian heritage that said, well, yeah, that is, we do think that all men are created equal. Mm-hmm. Now, we didn't live up to that because of slavery, but there was this whole premise of a moral tradition that they were inhabiting.
Yeah.
I think what's happened now is that has unraveled, right? So you start with liberalism back in the 16th and 17th centuries, move downstream a few hundred years. Now all that shared consensus underneath has unraveled. And what these post-liberal thinkers are saying is, yeah, and liberalism didn't give us any replacement for that. It never pretended to. It just said, let's just maximize individual freedom.
Yeah. And that's what I'm interested to see this post-liberal project, how it plays out. Is are they willing to go like to some sense of kind of go, hey, what actually got us to any semblance of flourishing was being connected to a distinctly Christian vision of civilization. Like, will they go that far, or have they so internalized the post-war consensus of a secular society that they're not, are they seeing all that they need to see? I think is the question here. And I know some people that are involved in this are theology professors. And so I hope that is, but I that is probably one of the biggest questions that I have with all the post-liberal talk is, do you have the, not just sort of the historical, like, hey, we kind of see this played out, but like somewhat of a like cultural guts to say, hey, actually we need to restore Christendom.
Well, here's what I think is interesting. I'll read you from their manifesto. They say, this does not mean that post-liberalism is mere conservatism. Rather, it regards the Western tradition as an eternal quest for the genuinely good life. It supports the classical and biblical view that the good life always consists in political participation, theoretical contemplation, and artistic creativity, but the nature of these activities is subject to constant development and reconsideration. What I think is interesting about that is they're using the language classical and biblical.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what Yoram Hazony does as well in his book on conservatism. He says there's an overlap between what you would call the Judeo-Christian heritage and the classical Greek and Roman heritage. And the overlap is, this is C.S. Lewis too, the overlap is a sense of the transcendent.
Mm-hmm.
We believe there's a good beyond this life.
Yeah.
And so in a sense, any tradition, I think you could say, you could have a Jewish community over here, a Christian community over here, a classical school over here, some Buddhists down the street, and any tradition that has a sense that there is a transcendent good that we ought to be pursuing, I think those people together can build a shared vision of society, because I don't think we necessarily have to have consensus on the good. As long as we have consensus on there is a good outside of us that we ought to live in pursuit of. That seems to be what they're saying, is liberalism got rid of that transcendent moral order. And when you get rid of the transcendent moral order and you say, hey, let's just maximize our personal freedom in the here and now, well, devoid of any moral authority or any transcendent vision of what is the good that I should be pursuing, there's no way for me to have any guardrails that would keep me from, at your expense and at your expense, maximizing my own individual wealth or power or freedom.
So there is room for a pluralism.
I think so. I think that's what they're saying.
Yeah. Asking questions here, I'm curious, like how much of a pluralism, because even like what you described of, hey, there's a shared sense of transcendence, but not all of them agree on some of the particulars of transcendence. Yep. So how do those things coalesce and cohere into a shared vision that you can kind of function in within a society?
I have no answer to that question.
Yeah, no, that's fair. I think these are, and when I say, you know, and kind of showing my hand here a little bit, I think I am a bit more in kind of the, I don't know, for lack of a better term, and man, this is going to be a first of me like claiming to agree with Doug Wilson, but
Christendom kind of vibe.
Well, like that kind of stream, I'm wrestling through that because there is a sense of, and I appreciate what he's saying is, hey, we're not trying to go back and recreate exactly what it was, but understanding the nature of what kind of held society together and gave a vision of the good that was important. I'm like, we have to restore that to some degree. And what is that going to look like? And so I think that's the wrestle, because I hear what you're saying, what you described. I'm like, that sounds a heck of a lot better than kind of the liberal thing of just freedom.
Right.
But even that, is that going to be sufficient to kind of get us to where we need to be?
Yeah. Good question. I don't know the answer. And I think I'm great if it's not. I think these guys are trying to say, let's at least get into the conversation of, could we get the Doug Wilson people and the renewing conservatism people and the nationalists and the, you know, whoever else has a vision for what the good of society could be. Let's get those people at least talking to one another about the fact that we have to have some shared substantive vision of the good for there to be a society.
Yeah. Nope. That's
I don't know that's going to happen, but I think that's the danger, to go back to your pessimism, Dusty, because I'm a little bit, I think the pessimism I see is like, I don't know if we can have a society unless we can agree on some shared moral order, some sense of the good together, whether it's a Christian view or some other view. It does seem to me that their critique of liberalism rings true to me, because I think what you see, if you ask, like, what do you see on social media? What do you see in this sort of fragmentation of modern life? What you see is everybody buying into individualism that says, if I just get what I want out of life, life will be meaningful. And people can run on that for a long time, but because it's not true, because actually I can't get what I want out of life unless other people flourish as well. Like, this is what Jesus said, right? You know, the first will be last, right? Mm-hmm. The greatest is a servant of all. The deepest joy in life comes from helping other people flourish. And because no one's talking about that in our culture, because the vision is all individual freedom and flourishing, what you have is a culture that sells people something that can't actually fulfill what it says it does. And so you end up with people who are really lonely, really isolated, really disheartened, but wealthy and decently well off in life, you know? So you have this, it feels to me that something's going to have to change
in our
social fabric. And I hope enough people start saying, yeah, politics and economics aren't enough to build a society on. There's a deeper layer of sort of shared humanity that we have to go back and ask, what would it mean for us to build on that?
Yeah.
To build something that allows us to flourish as people.
It seems like the answer to your question, Chris, would be, we would have to have enough momentum on virtue instead of exposing each other's vice.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Yeah,
that's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, I'm ripping that right out of this article,
yeah,
you know, and putting my own language on it. But in other words, like, it's going to take, well, in a sense, revival would be the Christian term, but there's going to have to be a momentous where we're suspending judgment of vice long enough to go, hey, actually, I think there's good in there. And I think we could possibly agree. And that's a whole new world.
And, I mean, and you even think of, you know, kind of hypothetical kind of pluralism here. I mean, you think of there are places where some of those religious systems have overlap of virtue. I mean, this C.S. Lewis, like there's a common grace understanding that people kind of carry because we're made in the image of God that we understand that, you know, when we hold to the transcendent, that leads us to, you know, to embrace certain virtues. And so, yeah, I think that there's certainly a possibility there. This thought came to me just a few minutes ago. You brought up like Elon Musk and kind of the technocratic leaders. And so like a guy like him, but it's interesting before the election, I mean, he was going off about, hey, we need to have more kids.
Right.
We need to, you know, like, so there's something in him that he's observing that there is more than just kind of politics and money, and where that's coming from might not all be, you know, from a great place, or he might have, you know, put the pieces together well, but he is intuiting something. He is recognizing something about society and what society has to have to flourish. And so just at the level of people seeing a civilization start to kind of fall apart makes us all kind of open our eyes and realize, whoa, what we've been doing isn't sustainable. And so you start asking kind of the deeper questions, which is a good thing. When you have a guy like Elon Musk asking questions about civilizational flourishing and actual just survival, you're like, okay, maybe we are at kind of a tipping point here where something good can come of this conversation.
Well, I think to try to, because the problem with this article is it is very philosophical. And so like it uses a lot of big words. It's a lot of political philosophy. It's not written where the average reader is going to be like, oh, I totally am like right on board with what they're saying. But to boil it down, Dusty, you use the word virtue. And the other word I think that's important is belonging. I think what they're trying to argue is for us to have a social fabric that actually works, we have to have some shared vision of virtue. What is a good person? And a shared sense of belonging. What's the thing we belong to? And they're just saying liberalism didn't give us either of those things. It gave us vice to avoid, and it gave us a very individualistic, atomized, just go do whatever makes you happy.
Yeah, survival.
Right. And so if you think about what does the gospel give us that we might have to offer to this conversation, it's those two things, a vision of virtue and a vision of belonging. And what I want to suggest, what I want people to think about, you mentioned, Chris, either in this episode or the previous one, the idea of natural law. I want to help Christians think about that even for people who do not embrace Christ as Savior, the Bible still holds forth a vision of a virtuous life and a sense of what it means to belong to one another. Because there's a human vision the Bible gives us of what does it mean to be a human community, right? The first 11 chapters of Genesis show us we're created in the image of God, whether we worship him or not. We can't get away from the fact that we belong to one another as human beings. And we can't get away from the fact that like the story of Cain and Abel is meant to show us murder and hatred are bad, care and concern for one another are good. So there's this virtue and belonging that is most realized in Jesus and in the gospel, but that actually we have a common grace thing to offer to the world here. And that's what's interesting about some of the Christendom proposals is I think if they can lean into the reality that like, hey, actually what Christians have to say to people is, hey, we can show you how to live a good life and we can show you what it means to belong and have a sense of human solidarity. And I think what you'll find if you look into that is that actually you should follow Jesus and become one of his disciples because that's where it's most fully realized. But even if you disagree on that, the Christian vision does give us both virtue and belonging.
Yeah, the way that we want to structure society, even if there is room for pluralism, still is going to lead to your flourishing.
Right.
Like, so that there's a positive vision.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So again, I a real heady topic here, but for the sort of summary, as a listener, I think you need to think about what did unfettered freedom promise us and where has it fallen short? And how does the scripture call us to something different? And what might that give us to offer the world? Because what these authors are saying is, hey, liberalism has died. Something needs to replace it. we're not, there's not a consensus on what that is yet, but I think we can agree that liberalism has sort of breathed its last, or at least that's what it seems to be the case to me. And I think the world is asking right now, America, the West is asking, what can take the place of that? And that's an interesting moment for us to be alive and to be representing the Lord Jesus Christ.
The goal of this podcast is to equip our own church for discipleship and mission. So if you're a Christian or a church leader in another context, thanks for listening in. And we pray that this conversation might be helpful to you as you minister in your context. We always love to hear from listeners. So if you have thoughts, questions, future podcast topics, send an email to podcast@cdomaha.com. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time for another episode of the Wednesday Conversation.